The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you once again to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. Now, there's perhaps no more perennial topic in American history than those clowns in Congress. And once again, those clowns in Congress are up to their usual circus. But it could be that this week's turn of events, both with the sort of slight 45-day delay on the shutdown and the defenestration of Kevin McCarthy as a House Speaker, have sort of like larger implications. To take this all up, I'm very happy to welcome once again a frequent guest, my Nation colleague, Chris Lehman, who I'm happy to say, you know, is tasked with covering the clowns in Congress in Washington. Well, I don't have to, and the listeners don't have to, but he can certainly bring an informed perspective as to what's going on. So maybe just like, just briefly, just give an overview. What the hell is going on?
Well, it's difficult to know where to begin, but, you know, the seeds of Kevin McCarthy's downfall were suitably planted in Kevin McCarthy's rise to the speakership, which is to say, listeners may remember that back in January when he got the gavel, he had to suffer this sort of 15-vote hazing in his own caucus before he got the 218-vote majority behind him. And that involved buying off the hard right forces around the Freedom Caucus. And Matt Gaetz was one of the ringleaders of that revolt back then. And one of the key concessions he got from McCarthy was the restoration of the motion to vacate procedure, which Nancy Pelosi had previously killed off. And it basically allows any one member of Congress at any time to call a vote to see whether the speakership can be vacated. And that is what Matt Gaetz himself proceeded to do in perhaps one of the least surprising developments.
I think we'll file this under, like, why is that leopard eating my face?
Yeah. So, there are many layers of irony in this moment. One is, you know, when you put in to run a caucus in a chamber of Congress that is ideologically opposed to the idea of government, when you start actually doing stuff that looks like government, in this case, procuring a last-minute continuing resolution to keep the government functioning in this budget showdown, you have an angry revolt on your hands. And McCarthy was unable to corral, you know, it turned out pretty much Gaetz got exactly the number of votes he needed on the Republican side, 8 votes in addition to the entire Democratic caucus voting in support of the motion to vacate McCarthy's speakership. So that's sort of one irony is, you know, that Kevin McCarthy was sort of boxed in. He wanted a job where he got to wield power and make the big decisions. But the moment you actually do that in such a way that makes it look like government is functioning, you know, there's hell to pay. So the real problem is, you know, not so much who holds the post of speaker on the GOP side. It's the caucus, and they are just bound and determined. We know this from the past, you know, resignations of Paul Ryan and John Boehner, who also had caucuses with a very restive kind of Tea Party caucus that was determined to provoke a budget shutdown. In each case, those speakers sidestepped the shutdown, and it didn't get to a motion to vacate, but they were basically forced out. Boehner was facing a revolt, as was Ryan, and they quite rationally decided, who needs this? The weird thing is that Kevin McCarthy was so single-mindedly focused on the job that he, I think, just failed to ask himself whether the game was worth the candle. And
yeah,
it's almost, if it weren't so farcical, you could say it's like a Greek tragedy. So this is someone being punished for his hubris, but it's all too, ridiculous for that. Especially, it's now emerging, I think, McCarthy's play in the continuing resolution fight was to, he didn't actually think the Democrats would go for the final version of the CR. And that's why he very stupidly went on the Sunday talk shows on this past weekend and said, you know, basically the Democrats wanted a shutdown. The only way he was going to broker a deal to save his speakership was to peel off some moderate Democrats to, you know, support him. And in that moment, he just kissed all of them off. So, like, you know, the one thing that speakers are supposed to be good at, and what I will, I'm not generally a Nancy Pelosi fan, but she was very skilled at being a whip, of counting the votes you actually have, making sure she got, you know, the signature legislation through that she needed to. You know, she had an even narrower majority her last time as speaker than McCarthy did, and she got it to work. So
that is actually a very clarifying comparison to make, because Nancy Pelosi did manage to govern with a, you know, like, as you say, a narrower majority. And, you know, it's not like the Democrats are a unified party. I mean, this is, you know, like, yeah, historically,
the most durable narrative template in Washington is Democrats in disarray. Right. So maybe this episode can retire that hoary.
But the Democrats in disarray, I mean, like, does reflect the fact that the Democrats are a heterogeneous party that, you know, like, is a coalition of many different groups and ideologically diverse, you know, like, between the sort of moderate centrist wing and now has a real social democratic wing. But still, I think on the Democratic side, despite all the diversity and difference and ideological disagreement, everybody's pretty committed to governing. And therefore, if you have a caucus where everyone, you know, realizes we have to govern, we have to, like, come to some point, and you have someone like Nancy Pelosi, who I do think deserves credit as someone who, like, you know, knew how to find that that point where everyone can rally around and knew how to count before she took a vote, then you can function. Whereas, I mean, the Republicans are in a complete contrast, and the whole thing highlights, like, just, you know, how incapable of governing the Republicans are. It's not just that, you know, they're factionalized. Democrats are also factionalized. It's that, you know, it's not a party that's committed to governing. And that sort of brings it, you know, maybe the second question, the roots of all this. And I'll link to this in the show notes, but the great political scientist Theda Scotchball has an interview in Politico where, you know, she traces this back to the Tea Party. And there's a sort of meme that's going around from this book from the Tea Party era of the Young Guns, which features, I believe it's like Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, and
Eric Cantor,
you know, all of whom, you know, rode in as the Young Guns, the future of the Republican Party, and all of whom have been unceremoniously defenestrated.
Yeah, though, you know, the one thing I will say, two of the people on the cover of that book did go on to be Speaker of the House, Ryan and McCarthy. So, you know, the book, in some ways, was not wrong.
No, it's right that this was the future, because it was also the future. Right. It was a very truncated, chaotic future.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, Sam Rayburns here.
or Paul Cannons or whoever. Right. No, it's definitely a new generation of leadership. And I think the Scotchball analysis is largely right. But I would amend it to say it goes further back to Newt Gingrich.
I should clarify. Yeah, I mean, Scotchwell's analysis is that this is like all the Tea Party. It's the Tea Party coming home to roost. You know, once you have the extremists of the Tea Party coming in, you know, like, that makes it impossible for the Republicans to govern. But as you were saying, you know, I mean, that analysis, which we can agree on, that the Tea Party was a hugely important inflection point, we can go deeper. So,
yeah, I know. Gingrich, you know, pioneered the shutdown tactic, first of all, which is what generated this whole crisis for McCarthy. And, you know, Gingrich was also a fiercely anti-government enforcer of ideological discipline within the Republican caucus. And so, you know, he helped engineer some of the early leadership purges of moderates that went on to create the conditions in which the Tea Party could thrive. And, you know, but it is absolutely true that, you know, both Boehner and Ryan were faced with trying to, you know, do what Pelosi did successfully do on the Democratic side, you know, keep people in line, keep, you know, people focused on achievable legislative goals, you know, make trade-offs where trade-offs were possible. And it is true that, you know, as we have seen, you know, the McCarthy episode is kind of the limit case of right-wing chaos in Congress. You know, McCarthy did everything to appease the Freedom Caucus hard right faction. You know, he not only gave them the motion to vacate, he gave them all kinds of committee chairs and rule concessions. You know, he gave and he gave, you know, during the struggle to get him elected speaker, Matt Gaetz actually joked, you know, Kevin McCarthy has given so much away, I can't get any more. There are no more concessions to be got from him. And it, he wasn't wrong. Mm-hmm. And yet, this is the key point. It did not matter. You know, he was negotiating with terrorists, really. And, you know, there was no rational calculus to proceed on, as, you know, McCarthy went on to discover. You give them everything and they will still, you know, cut off your head. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. To be clear, like, this is a caucus where, like, just on these sort of procedural governance issues, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a moderate.
Yeah,
it's absolutely true. She is, like, you know, the one that will work with leadership and make concessions. And she is being, you know, touted or criticized, you know, within the caucus as a sellout.
Yeah, right.
As a compromiser.
Yeah, quite something to see her and Lauren Boebert go at it earlier, and now her and Gaetz. It is, you know, if you can sort of bracket what the real stakes are, and they are, you know, as you noted, you know, we just have a 45-day reprieve to the next shutdown battle. And whoever it is who moves into McCarthy's position will not have, you know, a relationship with the White House, will not have much of a footing in this chaotic caucus to get any sort of deal done. So we're looking at, you know, a very real prospect of another shutdown in November.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Also, the continuing resolution did not include funding for the Ukraine effort to resist the Putin invasion, and that is a huge issue that is now, you know, just totally thrown up into chaos. So,
that's worth pursuing. It's something we talked about, like, sort of off air, but I mean, McCarthy basically seems to have had some sort of, like, handshake deal. Yeah, with the Democrats that, you know, like, we'll have the continuing resolution without the Ukraine money, and then we'll bring a vote on the Ukraine, and then there's enough Republicans, and all the Democrats basically will vote for it. And then so the continuing resolution, you know, would have basically been just maintaining the status quo, with actually like a little bit more money for disaster relief. So it was actually like not a bad deal for the Democrats as it was. But now the Republicans have thrown this, you know, like by getting rid of McCarthy, there is no handshake deal and Ukraine is in doubt. And this, you know, I think we can have a little bit of discussion as to what's happening with the Republicans on this front, because there's, you know, a lot of puzzlement in American society that the Republicans are the ones that are, you know, don't want to resist the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And there is a kind of liberal school of analysis that, you know, basically Putin's puppets, right? These people are all right, in the, means. Which I think is like not a helpful analysis.
Right.
But it seems to me that like what we're seeing, if you look at the larger geopolitics of the Republican Party, of the Republican right, is that, you know, they want to disengage from Europe. Like, let the Europeans settle their own mess, you know? What's going on there doesn't affect us. But they want American security forces and American foreign policy to be concerned with what's happening south of the border, with the Mexican border. And we're seeing calls from, you know, presidential candidates for, like, you know, American military intervention invading Mexico, but also China, right? Like, that we have to ramp up against the war on China.
Right.
Now, this, like, mix of policies... Yeah. Is a familiar one. This is
98, you know, basically, right?
Yeah, no, but this is like the conservative foreign policy before the Cold War. This is the foreign policy of Charles Lindbergh, which was mistakenly called at the time isolationist. But if you look at who the isolationists were, many of them, you know, very much supported the Monroe Doctrine in the Western Hemisphere, wanted the U.S. to be a dominant force, and they wanted to stay out of Europe precisely as a way of making a deal. Their idea was, we're going to make a deal with Hitler. You get to be overlord of Europe. We get to be overlord of the Western Hemisphere. Yeah. And they were also very concerned with Asia. They worried about the yellow peril, as they called it. And they wanted, you know, American military might to be focused on Europe. And back then, like, you know, the historian Arthur Schlesinger used to say, you know, these aren't isolationists. They're Asia-lationists. Their focus was on, you know, the Western Hemisphere and Asia. So this policy mix... The Charles Lindbergh policy mix has returned. This is not your father's Republican Party, but it is your grandfather's Republican Party.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And it's interesting, too, because it's of a piece with, you know, Tommy Tuberville holding up these military promotions. It's a very, I forget who it was now, but someone who I was interviewing during the shutdown crisis and discussing, you know, the prospect of Ukraine getting left to twist in the wind was saying this is the most important shift in Republican politics, is this turn away from an aggressive sort of interventionist model of foreign policy. And it's, yeah, I think you're right. It's much more in the America First vein, you know, the old isolationists, you know, they did not fare well in the wake of World War II for good reason, but they did have, you know, what was a partially, you know, sustainable critique of military adventurism.
And,
and my worry is, you know, the insane chorus to invade Mexico suggests that, yeah, these are not isolationists, clearly.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there's one of the fun things about the Republican Party taxonomy, there is like two sort of wings. There's the people, the America First people, the Charles Lindbergh people, who aren't really anti-interventionists. They want intervention, but they want
their kind of intervention.
Let's invade the countries to the south of the border and to the west of California. And but there's also, you know, like a tradition of, you know, genuine critique of military interventionism, of the sort of, you know, one associated with the name of Robert Taft, you know, who was certainly a very conservative person, very anti-union, you know, not our politics. But I would insist, a very thoughtful critic of American foreign policy, many of the critiques that he made of the national security state in the 40s and 50s of NATO, I think are still very resonant. And so, you know, there's these two wings of the Republican Party that are doubtful of war. I have to say, like, you know, I'm not seeing a lot of Robert Tafts around.
No, let's not forget, too, that the whole reason that Donald Trump basically accused former Chief of Staff Milley of treason was Milley was sending a reassurance in the wake of January 6th to China that we're not going to invade you. There's a lot going on there. And I think it's surfaced as a byproduct of this whole fight over the continuing resolution, and it's claimed McCarthy's speakership. So yeah, it's very difficult to kind of game out what happens next for Republicans in Congress.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, if like any one member of Congress can bring a vote, and you have such a narrow minority. I mean, this is like, I mean, you know, we're sort of unfortunate as journalists in the prediction game. But I've sort of learned that you can't really do it, because this is actually chaos theory. This is like a situation exactly. where like one butterfly can like cause a hurricane, right?
Yeah.
And but that was specifically...
No, I would not go so far as to call Matt Gaetz a butterfly.
No.
Forms of insect life that...
Yeah, that's right. Or one scorpion can cause a hurricane. So, I mean... the only thing one can predict is that we can't predict anything except chaos.
Right.
There's a greater likelihood of a shutdown, and there's a huge problem of governance. That I'm not a fan of consensus, but one can kind of see that this, there's no even minimum foreign policy consensus. So how are American allies going to rely on anything?
It is a real these are the real serious stakes, and I'm with you in some ways. Like I kind of wish the Democrats had not on the same scale and certainly not with the same agenda, but had some of the leadership purges that the Republicans have had. You need young leadership. Mm-hmm. There's a definite gerontocracy problem on the Democratic side of things. And, I would be lying if I said, I thought to myself at the time, even Paul Ryan is not acceptable to the Republicans in Congress. That's, it's crazy, but it's a little, actually Perry Bacon in the Washington Post had a good column today, kind of making the devil's advocate argument that, it's healthy to get new leadership on board somehow. And it's inherently messy, and who knows? I mean, this is, I think Perry would agree that this is not what Democrats want, but it is worth, putting a pin in that kind of devil's advocate argument that, the House is supposed to be the most democratic chamber of governance, and, it is healthy to have dissent. And
I think that this sort of chaos and sort of empowerment of this more extremist wing does give your party a lot of energy. And this does kind of explain why, despite everything, I think a lot of Democrats are always puzzled, all the things that Republicans do, why are they still, occasionally winning elections?
They're still well positioned. That was the point of Perry's column today is within Washington, you look at all this and you think, the inmates have taken over the asylum or whatever. And yet, if you go over to the polling, Trump is very much a viable candidate. Mm-hmm. Republicans have gotten a really dramatic advantage in managing the economy, which makes no sense. Their track record on, particularly on jobs, but somehow, all of this chaos does not register as disqualifying.
Well, it just thinking in terms of pure political things. The thing is that this chaos energizes the base. It gets a real.
It's true, right?
Yeah, they feel like there's a stake in party leadership that they could take power. And you get a lot of people that get very vested in it. Whereas, the Democrats, the sort of steady
it's
as you go.
It's basically we give the keys over to Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer.
Yeah,
and they're experienced
and Joe Biden.
Professionals and Joe Biden, yes.
Yeah. And it's just tamping down enthusiasm and energy.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of political problem. I'm sort of reminded that, Gore Vidal, I'm going to mangle it, but Gore Vidal had this line about 30 or 40 years ago where he says, the paradox of America is that the Liberal Party is senile, whereas the Conservative Party is puerile. One would not expect the Liberal Party to be stuck in the mud, and the Conservative Party to be full of angry children throwing tantrums. But America is a land of miracles. We have achieved those.
No, it is absolutely true. And the sort of paradox I keep returning to in my own reporting is somewhat related. The Republican leadership is afraid of its base, and the Democratic leadership hates its base.
That's exactly the dynamic.
Yeah.
And that is why things the sort of the deep structural thing that, you know, keeps the Republicans viable as they become more extreme.
Yeah, no, it is a really interesting dynamic. And it's you know, it's something I'm very mindful of working here in D.C., which is, you know, so beholden to the idea that politics should be administered by a professional class and the, you know, the public should be several steps removed.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So I think we've covered a lot of ground. There'll be much more to say in the coming weeks. But to listeners, all I can say is, you know, the clowns in Congress, they continue to be up to their buffoonery, but in ways that are like not just entertainingly clownish as one would like, but with serious repercussions.
You could call them killer clowns.
Killer clowns. Yeah, Stephen King clowns from It. So again, I want to thank Chris for being on the program.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to you.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.